The following message is brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. To learn more about the Ezra Institute's mission to advance the Lordship of Christ, please visit www.ezrainstitute.ca.
Coming back a little bit to some of the sublime mystery aspects of the Incarnation. The other day we were discussing some of Augustine's sermons on Advent and some of these incredible paradoxes that he sees in the Incarnation. And we were reflecting a little bit just on how that was prior to the Council of Chalcedon in AD 451, as they wrestled with how to best describe the union of these two natures. So as Christians, we're always careful to maintain the creator-creature distinction, which you've talked about. I mean, we don't assume divinity in our being brought into Christ. When Christ assumes flesh and becomes man, he whilst he does not consider equality with God something to be grasped, he makes himself a servant. He nonetheless remains fully God and fully man. Help us understand just perhaps a little bit about how the fathers like Augustine and some of the other patristic fathers helped tease out this understanding that led to that important definition at Chalcedon.
Well, this is a question that was debated for centuries, and a lot of the debate had to do with terminology and conceptually, how do we think about this? I think the benefit of these paradoxical expressions, and you do see it especially in the preaching around Christmas from Augustine, from Leo the Great, there's a wonderful Syrian poet named Ephrem who really almost revels in these paradoxes of the divinity and the humanity. Poetically and paradoxically, I think that is the way to talk about it. But jumping ahead to Chalcedon wanted to enshrine and put down in terms of a formula how the church had always been talking about it. Mm-hmm. So here's a doctrinal statement which reflects what we've kind of known, at least in our gut and in our prayers and in our songs all along. And they're very careful how they defined it, because they wanted to affirm, on the one hand, one person, and I'll come back to that, two natures, full humanity, full divinity, one person. But when it came to trying to articulate the relationship between the humanity and the divinity, they're joined, they're in union. But when it came to describing that, they simply used four negative adverbs. So without mixture, without confusion, without division, without separation. In other words, they're saying there's full humanity, full divinity, in union of one person, Without this. So not. It's four negative statements. So they don't want to actually positively say this is how it works. Because there's a recognition this is a mystery. It is beyond us to try to define or explain by means of a formula the Incarnation. So that's how the church had always talked about it, though, recognizing the distinction between the humanity and the divinity, but never mixing them, never separating them. Now, when it comes back to the single person, I think that's where it's really important to hold on to that. And this is where some theologians use the term a single subject Christology. And I find this way of thinking about it more helpful than the more philosophical discussions concerning person and the Greek term hypostasis and these kinds of things. That can all get a bit confusing. And it's assuming certain definitions about philosophical categories. But the single subject approach just simply looks at things from a very simple grammatical perspective. So if you think of a sentence, you have a subject, you have a verb, you have an object, or sometimes just a subject and a verb. But subject, David runs. And there's always just one subject when you're reading through the Gospels concerning Christ. There's always a single subject. And this was the problem with Nestorius and Nestorianism. And some of that school, they were positing two subjects. Sometimes God does things like calms the storm. Other times, the human Jesus of Nazareth does things, like he weeps. So they would say two subjects, and they would read through the Gospels and distinguish, okay, here's God acting, here's Jesus of Nazareth acting. But the church wisely said, no, we shouldn't make that kind of a distinction. So a single subject, everything that Jesus of Nazareth does, the person of the Son of God is doing. So I hope that's clear. Just thinking about it, a single subject, not two subjects, not two persons or two subjects operating. But that's helpful because when it comes to the experience, for example, of suffering on the cross, did God suffer on the cross? Yes, he did. We affirm that as Christians. He suffered on the cross because the Son of God, the person, the subject of the Son of God, suffered on the cross. Now, he suffered in his flesh. He suffered in his human nature. He didn't suffer in his divinity. He suffered in his human nature. And what these paradoxes bring out, so for example, he is commanding the armies of the angels and the Word of God who sustains all things, the Word of God who's commanding, who brought creation to existence and being, is a baby who can't speak. You know, there's both there. Mm-hmm. The creator of Mary is brought forth by Mary. The one who supplies the milk to her breasts is nursing from those same breasts and needs that nourishment to survive. So that's where we get the paradoxes, and the church fathers will build these up, you know, again and again and again. And it's quite wonderful to hear it, especially as it builds, because you just start to enter into and appreciate the mystery of it. But what that's saying is, fully God, fully man. Mm-hmm. As God, he's commanding the armies of the angels. As a human being, he is helpless and silent, can't speak in his mother's arms.
Thank you for listening to this message brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. Please feel free to share it with friends, but do not charge for or alter the material in any way without the express written consent of the EICC. Thank you.